Ladies and gentlemen, this is the QTR Podcast. Today is September 3rd, 2019. Before we get started today, first and foremost, this podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up through Patreon and donate a monthly recurring sum to keep this podcast alive. I want to shout them out, and then we're going to get started with today's interview. First and foremost, my friends over at the Sang Lucci Steam Room. The Sang Lucci Steam Room is a group of traders that have become experts in options, market flow, and tape reading. They have a master course that they are offering. They follow the big money in the options market to try to forecast and telegraph where the equity markets are going. There's a link to their master course in my podcast description. Also, they are now offering something called the 3LT Playbook, which are the three rules that Lucci has used to make himself into a seven-figure trader. Check Sang Lucci out in the podcast description. All the links are in there. I've known these guys for 7 or 8 years. Very good guys. This podcast also brought to you by my friend Pete over at thetraderspath.com. The Traders Path is a brand new investor education and investor advocacy website. They post morning watch lists. They have a daily live stream that shows you what names they are looking at, and they aim to educate investors, help out day traders with none of the nonsense and the BS that you get with some of these other trading services. In fact, Pete, who started the Traders Path, is a defector from some of the other trading services that you may have seen advertised on YouTube and said, you know what? I'm going to do my own service. I'm going to do this the right way and do it on my own. So you can check out a link to the Traders Path in my podcast description as well. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Rumorhound. Rumorhound is an AI-based piece of software that helps you sort through which rumors about mergers and acquisitions that you may be seeing either on Twitter or in chat rooms or in the media are worth noting and which ones may not be worth noting. It is a proprietary piece of AI software that looks at things like the company's financial position. It looks at the likelihood of transaction. It looks at the sourcing behind the rumors and tries to give you as a trader, as an investor, the tools to understand whether or not an M&A rumor is worth checking out. Rumorhound, you can check them out in the podcast description. The link is there. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Focused Compounding. Focused Compounding is a group of traders that do nothing but try to identify opportunities in parts of the market that other people are not looking at. So if you're looking for esoteric ideas, stuff that has been swept under the rug in the nooks and crannies of the market, check out my friends at Focused Compounding. Their links are also in the podcast description, and you can follow them on Twitter. They post a lot of their ideas on Twitter, at Focused Compound. And the link to that is in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Helibacon. These are gentlemen that shoot machine guns out of helicopters in Texas. Also, my friends at Corvus Gold, my friend Piggly Wiggly, my buddy Russ Valenti, Matthew Zimmer, what's going on, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground and Traders for a Cause, Chris Bede, Ken R., and Chris Boas, also in the house, and some of my newest patrons before we get started today, my friend Jonathan Elliott, Tom K2, my buddy Thomas Liberty, great name for today's interview, my friends over at hashtag Fannygate, that is the people following the GSE scandal, Casey Ponder, Charles Zivkiniv, Chris Karahoff, King Combo, I think I got it right this time, Dylan West, Want2XL, Kumitas, Das Krumel, and a couple more before we get started that have been with me for a while, like Janos Zavarinos, Garth Palmer, I appreciate you, Mike Ackerman, Tom Alexander, Justin Vaccaro, Art Spurl is in the house, Wednesday 8 p.m. is still in the house, Shannon Russell, what's going on, I appreciate your continued contributions, Harrison, my friends over at Volteface Investments, you guys are the ones that make incredible interviews like the one we're about to embark on today possible, and I thank you guys genuinely for it. Two more things. I do generally recommend a two-drink minimum for this podcast, and I am not a financial advisor. This is not financial advice. I hold no licenses, and I hold no registrations. All right. As far as politicians are concerned, or former politicians are concerned, the gentleman that I have with me on the line today is probably the top of the mountain in terms of people that I would like to interview personally. I have with me Dr. Ron Paul, the former congressman from Texas, distinguished congressman for Texas, and advocate for liberty for decades now. It was Mr. Paul's presidential run in 2008 where I kind of actually found my own personal political identity. I didn't really even know what libertarianism was at the time, and when Dr. Paul kind of went mainstream in 2008, I started listening to a lot of the things that he was advocating for and realized he was touching on a lot of common sense points that made a lot of sense to me. And after looking at the candidates that year and then looking at Mr. Paul, he was the only one that literally practiced what he preached. His voting record did, his actions. And of course, he was always respectable in the way that he had discourse with other candidates and with people in the media. And so I'm incredibly honored to have you on today, Dr. Paul. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you so much again for taking some time for me today. We were talking a moment before about my podcast and generally what I cover primarily. And I do have a few questions here that I'd love to ask you, but I want to kind of get started in the financial world because we are kind of in these very interesting, unprecedented monetary policy experiments, I guess you'll call them right now, with manipulating interest rates lower the way that they've been. And now we're at this very strange impasse now, Dr. Paul, where the stock market is near all-time highs, but the economy may be sending a different signal. And you have a president that seems like he wants to cut rates and is now at odds with the Fed, who was really kind of doing the wrong thing to begin with. It's really turned into quite a mess. And I wanted to kind of get your take on that, maybe to get started, and let me know what you think of the state of the Federal Reserve today and where we're at.
Right, because it's an interesting subject, something I'm fascinated with, something I got involved in very early, even as I was a student in medicine and studying. I became interested in Austrian economics during the 1960s, and there were predictions made that this system wasn't viable. They were extending themselves. It was a fake gold standard. We weren't even allowed to own gold. And the predictions came true, and that was on August 15th, 1971. And to me, that is a very, very important date in monetary history, because I think what we're witnessing today is the climactic end of what we substituted the Bretton Woods with in 1971. And it was just another fake fiat standard, but it's bigger and more vicious and engulfed the whole world more than any other monetary system ever has. And it has nothing to do with sound money. It has to do with management of a fiat currency. And they've managed to pull this off and last a lot longer. But the longer a system like this lasts, the more imbalances there are.
Right.
And that means that there's more debt and more problems and a much bigger chore in trying to clean this mess up. But I think it's historic. I think it's coming to an end. And I think we're going to see a real, real big bust in the economy, because I think until we admit that we are bankrupt, both financially and morally, there can be no answers.
Yeah, the really strange thing with this experiment is the longer it kind of goes on, the more confirmation bias there is. You know, I always say, you know, we've really 40, 50 years we've been out of hand here. But over the course of history, that's a very, very short amount of time. And the further we kind of push forward, the more emboldened the economists and everybody that is kind of, even people that are involuntarily indoctrinated into this system, become that it's the right way to go. And the scary thing is, we don't really know when it's going to come to an end and what that catalyst is going to be, right?
Yes, and the other thing is a lot of people know there's problems. Even members of the Federal Reserve Board, I think, are much more aware of what's happening than they're willing to admit. But the problem is when there is a bankruptcy and you have to do what is necessary politically, it's untenable. Nobody would tolerate it, because if Trump or anybody else did exactly as they should, and that is get out of the managing of the money supply business and the interest rates, I mean, you would be thrown out of office so fast, and,
right,
and the adjustment would be just horrible. So that's not going to happen. So they're going to continue on the addiction. The addiction is on printing money. It's amazing that there has been as much confidence in the dollar. And people say, Ron, you're always talking about the danger of the dollar getting weaker and weaker in terms of gold. It keeps getting weaker and weaker. Sure. But when you measure it against other currencies, it's very strong because the other currencies are even worse.
Right.
but everybody's in this together. And I wished it weren't so serious because it can be very interesting to see what unfolds.
Yeah, you made a really interesting point there, and it's something that I talk about on this podcast all the time with guys like Peter Schiff and Bill Fleckenstein, and that's trying to discern whether or not the FOMC and, you know, the Federal Reserve Chair, whether or not they understand what's going on, and whether or not they understand the path that they are kind of walking down. And some people, you know, Peter Schiff and Bill Fleckenstein disagree on this. Schiff will say, you know, that they do get it a little bit. Fleckenstein will say 100% they're just buying their own nonsense and they don't even see where they're forging forward. It sounds like you think the Fed kind of understands it more than they let on.
I think so, but I think Bernanke was one that really believed his own garbage. You know, I think that is the case. But I had an interesting conversation with Volcker, and it was in 1979 at the height of the 70s when gold went from $35 up to $800, and there was a lot of fear going on. So I had an appointment to have breakfast with, but he didn't. He went immediately to his aide, and the biggest thing on his mind was, what's the price of gold?
Right.
He knew that gold was not that he was more sympathetic to gold than others. But what the point being is that gold is real money, and paper money can only exist when you can fool the people. And that's why when we fooled the people for a long time from 1932 up until 71, we said gold was worth $35 an ounce. You know, but it wasn't, and that's why it broke down. And there's that type of thing. But gold is the ultimate measurement of value. They know that, and that's why if they didn't think gold was money, they wouldn't work so hard to try to punish people who want to use it. When gold became legal in 1975, everybody expected to skyrocket, but it had already skyrocketed. It had already been discounted. But when gold became legal, guess what happened? The Treasury and the IMF dumped billions and billions of dollars worth of gold to try to punish the people that were trying to, you know, say gold was money. So no, they need to do that, and they will. But there's time they sort of lose control. I think they've sort of lost control now, but who knows what'll happen, because we're in uncharted waters today.
Yeah, we certainly are. And for me, I mean, the only thing that seals it for me, and I'll go back to your beautiful exchange that you had with Bernanke about a decade ago, is why do central banks hold gold in reserve? I mean, it's like, do as I say, not as I do, right?
Right. And his answer was, tradition.
Yeah, tradition.
But it couldn't be for money.
you said, why don't they hold diamonds? And he was like, you know, he just didn't have an answer. And when I look back on how I've kind of formed my opinions about the world of finance, I thank God, number one, that I didn't come out of an institution that kind of indoctrinated me with, Keynesian theory. But I look back to videos like that, and I'm just fascinated by them. I wanted to ask you another question. You know, we kind of talk about the indoctrination of the mom and pop into the Keynesian world that we're in now. There's a lot of people out there, Dr. Paul, that don't really understand that there's another way of thinking about economics than the way that our government and really governments across the world are operating with. They see inflation. They know that it's something that's supposed to happen. You know, they think it's something that's supposed to happen. They know prices go up. They don't really know why. And one of the questions I have for you, because one of my goals and the reason I do this podcast is try to get across to the people on Main Street that there is a different way to think about things. How do we do that? How do we get people that don't understand it to understand it a little bit better?
Well, it has to be by word of mouth. It has to be through education. And I think a program like yours does a lot of good by reaching a lot of people, because it's ideological, and the ideas of the universities aren't the answer. I can remember it dawning on me as I left college and I got more involved in politics, that my job seems to be unlearning the things that I had learned in government.
Right.
And so that is a challenge. And yet I think that's where the real progress is being made. I think it's educational. That's why I have a Ron Paul curriculum to teach about economics and history and everything necessary. And I also understand that, numbers are important, but they're not critical. You can't say, well, what we need to do, we have democracy. If we could just get 51% to vote for the right thing. I don't look at it that way. I look for getting the leaders of the community, the leaders intellectually, to understand issues, because that is what happened, in the early part of the last century. The Keynesians and the socialists and the interventionists and the planners and the anti-gold people, that was all intellectual, and then it came to fruition. But these guys coming out of college now, they're more likely to a socialist professor than there are any of us. But that doesn't really discourage me. It sort of spurs me on, because I'm impressed with what you do. You got a lot of people. That's great. But there's a lot of other people out there. I'm amazed that when I go around the country, I'll meet some young people that have their own organizations doing and are doing publications, and they're not dependent on, obviously the internet is helpful. It helps me, but they're not totally dependent on it, because even that has its shortcomings. They're reaching people in different manners by their own publications. So who knows, when people wake up and find out that the internet is not a source of truth, maybe there will be, maybe there'll be more pamphleteering going on. And that's what the people did in our early part of our history for a long time. Even before that, you wrote pamphlets and you passed them out and you talked about it. And ideas have consequences, and they're powerful, and that's what we should be emphasizing.
Well, I folded up and handed out some Ron Paul pamphlets in 2008 in the greater Westchester, Pennsylvania area, just to let you know. So maybe we do need to go back to that. Here's another question for you. Just to go back to what I touched on earlier, the students that are coming out of university now, to get to the point that you just made, don't you think that the more frightening thing now is the fact that they look back at probably the stock market, which is often conflated with the economy wrongly, and they see a stock market that has done nothing but go up over time. And especially over the last 10 years, the people coming out of university now, they weren't around, they were very young when 2008 happened, and some of them probably were just infants when the 2000.com bubble burst. Don't you think that, this is kind of feeding on itself a little bit? Just to go back to my point earlier about confirmation bias, I mean, doesn't that frighten you? Because
no, because it'll be taken care of abruptly. They're going to have a real lesson learned, and I think the crack is there. I think the crack in the empire is there. The foreign policy is going to change, and this modern monetary theory is so much garbage. Anybody with common sense are going to realize that it's not viable. So, but when the crash comes, how much lower can you go below zero on interest rates?
Right.
They have nothing left to do. And the markets, and I always work on the assumptions, markets are more powerful than the Federal Reserve and the FOMC.
Right.
And that's what I was saying in 1971. The markets overwhelmed and they had to give up, because they understood it. But sometimes it's very tedious. It takes a long time. People have to be patient, but people should not be so impatient that they're not doing something about it. And to me, that is spreading a message and getting people to understand that. I was very encouraged during the presidential campaigns, because I went into those universities, including places like Berkeley, and the reception was very good.
Right.
But I didn't go in there like a Republican defending the banks or anything like that. I defended personal liberty and why liberty is important to an individual. And if that is the case, you're a consumer. Why aren't you treated, the same? Your civil liberties belong to you as a consumer. You should be able to work for a living and keep what you get.
Sure.
And the young people, at least the ones that came to my rallies, they understood it very clearly.
Yeah. And I just want to ask you, you know, what kind of a role do you think, I want to talk about the media and the mainstream media a little bit. You know, you picked up incredible momentum in 2008 and 2012, you know, when YouTube was really blossoming into something incredible too. And thank God, you know, YouTube was around, because I had all these great videos and great interviews that you had done and great compilations of your moments. Because when it came to the debates, when it came to mainstream media appearances, I often felt like you got the short end of the stick. And so I have two questions I want to ask you. The first is, how complicit and how responsible do you think the mainstream media and financial mainstream media specifically is for leading people down the wrong path in terms of how they think about economics?
Well, they have a lot to do with it, and some are sinister and selfish and self-centered and doing it for power. But there is also a large number of them are just reflecting what they were taught in colleges, and I think that's a powerful weapon. The members of Congress that I knew that came, they may have gotten richer as they were there, but when they came, they were very sincere and trying to help people. They think it's a management problem, that if we just had a better FOMC, they could set interest rates a little bit better. But no, they just spouted off what they had been taught, and this is what the economic lessons were. They were always teaching this same thing, that Federal Reserves are important and fixing interest rates, and that protects the people and all this thing. But because it's going to fail, then we're going to have the opportunity to offer something different as a substitute.
Did you feel like in 2008 and 2012 that you were given a fair shake by the mainstream media?
No, but I wasn't a bit surprised, and I didn't dwell on it, and I looked at the positive side. I'm amazed. I didn't even think I'd get any attention. But of course, when I ran for Congress in 1975 and 76, the last thought in my mind was going to Congress. You know, I was just wanted to talk about the Bretton Woods thing. And so I never expected it. And somebody said, well, what about when you went to Congress? How did you stand that crowd of people? And what did you get past? What did you do? And I said, well, I didn't have any problem at all. I tried to get along with people. I said, as far as the way I did it is, I said, I just had low expectations. I didn't expect to change the world. So if you start with that and you have a message and you believe it's the right message and you just pursue it, sometimes it's surprising. So I never thought I'd, you know, run for president and get involved. As a matter of fact, the debates back in 08 and 12 were much more conducive for what I was doing than they would be for this year. Just think look at how Tulsi Gabbard is being so.
Wow.
You know, she has a greater hurdle to get over than I ever did, because you know they probably try to do it, but the situation was better, so I had some advantages there, much more so. And I just didn't, I was pleased, and because I still think that spreading ideas way to go, and the ideas are still out there, and I think that what can I do it if I say, well, no, it's not working, let's not do this. I do it because I think it's worthwhile, and I do it because I believe it's right, the right position to have, and that is a very positive. And besides, I enjoy doing it, and I tell the students that I talk to at the universities, I said, because I talk to a lot of the YAL groups, and I said, look, you get together, and you know what you believe in, you work for it, and you should have some fun doing it. And that's what I emphasize, because you can't dwell on the fact that We're failing. How are we ever going to do this? How are we going to get rid of the Fed? I just say, the Fed will get rid of itself. Don't worry about it. Because it's not viable. It's not viable. And when are the wars going to stop? I'd like that to be hurried up. But the wars are going to be stopped when our empire fails, and the empire is failing.
Right.
And we can't gather up the support that we used to. Besides, we're not going to have any money. And we watched the Soviet system collapse, and we're going to witness the collapse of the controls that we've had around the world. I think it's already started. So I would think in the next 5 years, everybody's going to know that we're not the powerhouse that we have pretended to be.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that really impressed me about you, I mean, I was in my 20s, my early 20s, when I started to watch you in 2008 leading up to that election. Not only was the fact that you practiced what you preached, and literally, but also in that your voting record, you know, was extraordinarily consistent for, you know, especially for a congressperson. I mean, the people that vote, you know, people often change their stance day in and day out. And you were just, the other thing was how civil you were when, of course, I felt that you were constantly being cut off, wrongfully attacked, not given as much attention as you should have been as a presidential candidate. And I just think it takes an immense amount of control to be able to get through those situations and not just completely lose it. So that was very impressive to me as well. Go ahead. I don't know if you wanted to respond to that.
Well, you know, I think I made an effort to do that because I always believe that demeanor makes a difference. My goal was spreading a message, and the demeanor makes all the difference in the world. Because let's say we're absolutely sure that we have to get rid of the Fed, blah, blah, blah. And then you start grabbing people and saying, why are you such an idiot? You know? And, because you're an idiot, you know, and just going after them. And then back off a little bit and say, well, I know what's right, so I'm going to work within the system and I'll play ball with them and I'll become a chairman of the Banking Committee. And I just didn't think that was the way you change people's minds. If you're in politics, that's what you do. But if you're in the business of trying to change people's minds and attitudes, I think, you know, personal relationships are important. You shouldn't – it undermines what you're trying to do.
Right.
And so it was it would have been more difficult. Let's say you're my advisor. You come up to me, Ron, you're losing it because you're way too soft. You should tell these people off. You know, and let them know where you stand. Well, I wasn't inclined to do that, and besides, I didn't think it was practical.
You just talked about Tulsi Gabbard, and I have an immense amount of respect for her as somebody that served the country. And I don't agree with her on you know some things. I do lean towards how she feels about foreign policy. It was actually one of the questions I wanted to ask you was whether or not you know. A, she was being given a fair shake, which I don't think that she is. And if not, do you think it is a result of her non-interventionist foreign policy?
Well, no, she's not getting a fair shake, but she has to realize that she's in a hornet's nest. I think what she does is dramatizes how badly, you know, the progressive Democrats and anybody who wanted to be independent and progressive have drifted away because...
Right.
You know, right now, if you had everything turned over to the Democrats, they're the most aggressive, you know, against Russia. You know, in the 60s, the left were the ones that were pro-Soviet, you know, and they like communism. But now that we're getting along better, now they hate Russia and we should be more aggressive.
Right.
So I think she's in a hornet's nest, but she should just put her head down and say what she believes because she will reach people outside of the Democratic circles. So
sure.
And I don't know what her goals is. I haven't met her, and I don't know. I'm sure her goals are to, you know, spread a message as well as participating in the process, you know, the best she can. But I think she has been, you know, attacked and mistreated maybe even more than I was. I don't know. But I don't think about those kind of things.
Yeah, and I think her time as a servicewoman and somebody who is still serving on active duty recently was on active duty, I think 3 weeks ago. I think it qualifies her uniquely to weigh in on foreign policy. And I think that that's something that the mainstream lot might not like, because it's tough to go back to somebody and say, you don't know what you're talking about when they say, hey, I just got off the plane back from, you know, Afghanistan or wherever she was stationed. I do know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and even though the media may be 100% against a person like Tulsi, and like they were against me, and I didn't try to figure it out and dwell on that, because, you know, the confrontation I had with Giuliani, you know, was a significant event. And I remember afterwards you know, I thought, well, it was interesting and a little annoying. And so I was walking off, but everybody was, oh, and reporters would come up, oh, you're going to drop out. Aren't you going to drop out? You know, I was still not even thinking along those lines. Well, why would I want to do that? And it turned out that although all the media, and they are today all pro-war because they're all, you know, part of the military-industrial complex.
Right.
All of a sudden, you know, I was saying something that a lot of people were thinking.
Right.
I don't know what your reaction was like back then. You must have had, if those views were attracted to you, you must have had them. They probably weren't totally brand new. You would say, and you know, I used to kid and say that. And I am glad that some of these very, very well-known, you know, academics, you know, they agree with me. No, but the whole thing is I think people think about it and they think they're totally alone and they can't say it.
Right.
And I think that's what happened. All of a sudden, I couldn't believe it. And, you know, instead of the total destruction, elimination of anything I ever said in politics, it was the beginning. It was only the beginning of what I was destined to do.
Well, it was strange, you know, because as a teenager and in my early 20s, as you grow up in this country, what it appears to the outside observer before you educate yourself is that there are two parties, and you have to take or leave all of their stances on all of the issues across the board to support one of them. So you know, for instance, you can't be an economic conservative and take, you know, adopt that kind of conservative view and also kind of juxtapose that with being socially liberal. And discovering kind of your platform in libertarianism in general was the first thing to me that told me that there was something else out there, and of course landed on almost all of the issues 100%, and I was actually fascinated by how simple it was too. And again, it bears repeating, I was fascinated by how much you walked the walk and didn't just talk the talk either. So I guess from there we'll move on. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, I read your book End the Fed, which is a fascinating read some years back. And we were just talking about kind of the Federal Reserve will take care of itself, is what you said, or it'll destroy itself. What would if Ron Paul was in charge, what would the Fed look like right now?
It wouldn't exist.
Well, even you have said in past interviews that, you know, you wouldn't just go in and eliminate it immediately.
Which is just sort of an academic statement, because you can't do that. Nobody's going to be responsible for doing it. I wouldn't be in that position. So, you know, kiddingly, what I say is I just would resign.
Right.
But if you were, let's say the country really did shift, that our views were being expressed by all the universities and the members of Congress that were coming there all agreed with us, we still could devise a transition. We could work it out where you don't close the Fed down one day. You take the old tradition, let it exist, but then you legalize the competition. You legalize free market banking. You legalize competing currencies. You get rid of taxes on silver and gold. And then you start nibbling away at the power of the Fed. You could just say that you can't buy government debt or something like that, or you can't set interest rates, which would totally destroy everything that they would do.
Right.
You could do it and probably work your way out. But I don't think about that, just to make the point. And the point is nobody would tolerate it. I mean, if you mess around by closing things down and we're now down at 2% and going to -2, the whole country would go nuts, and the markets would speed things up.
Right.
And that's what's going to happen. And but you could set, you know, some rules where you could have a transition. It's just that I don't talk a lot about that because I don't think it's ever going to happen. I think we should be talking about what's it like not to have a central bank. People say central banking's on the defensive. Fortunately, they are. And how does it work? Well, we have quite a few years in our history where we didn't have a central bank, and for a long time, the world did not have central banks where they just created fiat out of thin air.
And, you know, how long would a first off, I guess, you know, is it possible to make a transition like that? Like you say, you kind of start nibbling away at these rules here and there. You know, is it possible to make that type of transition over decades, probably, do you think, and kind of slowly turn the ship around without creating a massive cataclysm?
Well, it all depends on what the people are thinking and what the Congress has made up and whether they're going to tolerate it. And I don't think there's any chance of that happening. But we do have one example in our history that shows that you can do it. And that was, they suspended the gold standard in the Civil War period in 1861. It came back, in 1875, they decided, well, things aren't going well and we should go back to the gold standard. So they had the resumption resumption bill. They passed it and they had a transition of 3 years and they were going to quit printing greenbacks and withdraw some greenbacks. And we weren't fighting any foreign wars. We didn't have a welfare state. The people then actually believed the government. Nobody would believe the government today because everybody said, you know, everybody owes, they're owed something. But no, there was a resumption. There was a transition and it worked. But we don't live in 1875.
Right.
You know, this is a different world. So that's why it's not likely to work. I think in theory it can work, but we're not there. And that is the reason why we have to keep, not arguing the case, well, how can we bring the Fed down? What we should be arguing is trying to persuade a whole new generation that if you ever have anything to say about this, that you promote sound money and promote, limiting the Fed and promote, the metals for money, something
sure.
that the politicians can't manipulate.
I mean, let's just go back, touch on the price of gold real quickly. Gold is up again. It's up. Gold futures are up $25 today. Silver futures are up, silver futures are up 4%, almost 5% right now. You think with the market being as extended as it is right now, do you think people are starting to get a little bit of a clue? Is that what gold and silver in the metals market's telling you now?
Oh, yes, I absolutely. And they have a lot of time to make up. They should have discovered this a long time ago. but just think how long they kept it at $35 an ounce. So they've been able to maintain it. But they've been aware of this. But people should have awakened when the QE started, 10 years ago when they started
right.
doing QEs. What we're doing is we're just discounting all the harm done with the QEs instead of it. These rules, so if you print too much money, the ratio to gold changes. But it should have been known before. But not only do we have the catch up to do with the gold price, on the QEs, we have the future to look forward to, and the future is very bleak because the United States is not going to be the powerhouse. We have too many enemies, and people are sick and tired of our sanctions and fighting these trade wars and doing all the things that we do. So we're losing the credibility, and that is helping also. The interesting thing is that when you look at the chart of the dollar with other currencies, we still have a strong currency. But at Jackson Hole, just the other day, they talked about, well, this is getting out of whack. Maybe we should do something, to weaken the dollar. that's why I think, for many reasons, gold is going up. Past reasons, as far and current reasons, and turmoil that's going on right now.
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to ask you about, one of the things that I often speculate about on this program and to varying degrees of responses from my guests, but kind of a dream question that I would love to ask you about is, we know that the Fed intervenes in the bond market, obviously. We know that the Fed has dipped their hand in many parts of the capital markets and in the economy in general. From your experience, is the Fed in the stock market? Is the Fed in equity futures or in equities?
Oh, I believe they are. And that's they don't want us to know the details, and that's why they won't let the audit go through.
Right.
Because you could find out. And I think they're pretty blunt about it. They are more, you know, closer to admitting this. They said they were in a political system, but it looks like they're interested in not letting Trump get reelected. So they're very political. But the president's working group on financial markets, I mean, that's their job.
Yep.
Is to keep the stocks from going down. And usually low interest rates will do that. But last time, when they raised that interest rate a quarter of a point, the markets didn't think that was enough. And lower, that was one time where lowering the interest rates didn't matter. So they're losing their credibility. But they call it the plunge protection team. And I think they buy and sell. They're involved. I mean, when you think of what they control secretly in the plunge protection team, everything from the Fed to the Treasury, the FDIC, the whole works. They have total control, and they're really not monitored at all. So I am sure that they will be and probably have bought. What about the bonds they hold?
Right.
You know, from the bailout. That's about as much as, you know, what more could they be doing in propping up, the dollar and the bond market? I mean, we own those things, and often wonder, because I don't know the answer, is I wonder what the real value is of all the bonds that they bought, their securities, those mortgage securities. So I'm sure they're not worth face value.
Oh, no. And that was always my line of logic there, Dr. Paul, was if we're able to, you know, intervene in the bond market in such a perverse manner, it's a very small line to draw to intervening in the equity markets. I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer. But I have, you know, guys that argue with me all the time, and they say, you know, just because we don't have the smoking gun, that it hasn't happened. So I don't know. I feel like I've only been around 36 years, but I've seen enough to be skeptical. So I just have two more questions with you. And again, thank you so much for taking this time with me today.
Let's finish up.
Sure. The first thing is an economics question. Then I'm going to ask you one more political question. When you're reading economists, and you know, when you're listening to lectures, who do you listen to now? When you open a newspaper, you're looking to try to read a specific reporter or maybe a specific economist. Who do you read, and who would you recommend that others read?
Oh, I try to read them all. I don't have one in particular. I know a website a couple websites have been very helpful to me, you know, like Anti-War and Lou Rockwell. I read their websites a lot. I like Zero Hedge, and you know, there are quite a few things like that you can get information from. But There's so many out there that I think are good, and everybody has their spin on things. But I don't have one individual that said, well, he says exactly everything that I think we should be said.
Sure. And finally, my last question, just to touch on another political issue, and then I'll let you go with the shootings that have been publicized here over the last few months. How do we get the message to people that, you know, you can't really put the genie back in the bottle when it comes to taking people's civil liberties from them, and making that argument in the face of such really an emotional argument? And when these horrible tragedies do happen, it is an extremely emotional emotional argument that comes from the other side. So I'd be interested to know how you characterize your stance there.
You mean on what you should do about guns?
Yes, exactly.
Well, of course, I strongly believe you have a right to own guns. I think that people take advantage of situations like that and use it as an excuse. But we need more people, you know, to point out that one of the best things that could happen to try to prevent this from happening, just think, you know, they talk about equality and all. I keep thinking that the equalizer, that was when, you know, a woman could carry a little pistol in her purse, and, you know, and yet the liberals who hate guns must hate women, because women aren't allowed to carry a gun in their purse. So, no, I believe in it strongly that they should have this, but I think we still need a lot more information. One that I talk a lot about, and that is these individuals that, you know, they're the young people, they're in school, and they're sort of, they just sort of go nuts and start shooting people. Almost all of them have been on drugs, and some of them are prescription drugs, antidepressants, and I don't think there's enough attention to that happens, but I think it's conditioning that has occurred, that a lot of people think that more laws will take care of it, and I don't think that is the case at all.
Well, Dr. Paul, listen, I want to say thank you very much for coming on and speaking to me today. It's been probably one of the coolest moments of my life to be able to speak to you. It's something I never imagined that I'd be able to do. It's been an honor to speak to you. I think you're truly one of the last American heroes and a fine patriot, and I just can't thank you enough for coming on and speaking to me today.
Thank you very much, Chris. Nice being with you.
All right. Talk to you later.
Okay.
That was the one, the only, Dr. Ron Paul. Pretty incredible that Mr. Paul made some time for me today. Very appreciative of that. If you guys enjoyed today's interview and you enjoy the podcast in general, and you'll note this is the first podcast I did not use any profanities either, because that's how much I respect Dr. Paul. I want to make sure that he was given the respect that he was due on this podcast. So if you enjoy the podcast, please sign up as a patron on Patreon and check out the rest of the content. I'll be back. I have a couple of super interesting guests booked for the next couple of weeks and look forward to being back and speaking to you all. But right now, I'm out.
Peace!